And I'm Tom Rowe in on the WGXC Feedback Show this Saturday morning, and Amanda Dawn Christie is here. You've got the easiest name of any of our... we've had lots of foreign name, hard to pronounce for simple American radio announcers. But you're here from Canada, too.
Yes, so as simple to pronounce as it is, it's still foreign.
And you're around French speakers all the time, so...
Yeah, I'm actually bilingual. I'm from the only bilingual province in Canada.
And have you ever heard Alan Lamb's wire recordings before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, he takes, I guess, contact mics on these giant... there's some giant Australian transmission lines that are some of the biggest in the world, I guess, and makes very delicate, subtle recordings of the... sounds of the electrical flow. But that's not what we're hearing now. We're hearing now Dream of TV from Circuit de U. I don't ever know how to pronounce that. And we're also in the pond, Wave Farm. You can hear a little bit of the sounds of the pond station, Zakpos pond station hydrophones recording. The microphones in the woods don't seem to be working this morning again. I was told they were fixed yesterday, but everything was okay. But
where are the microphones in the woods?
Oh, there's just one on top of the truck.
Oh, nice.
On top of the radio truck. The former Stockport Fire Department radio truck is in the woods here at Wave Farm, thanks to Max Goldfarb. It's his M49 truck, and we have a studio out there in the woods. And so I'm not sure if something in our feed from the studio is not working, or the microphone is... we checked. The microphone is working, so...
I did listen to the pond a lot this morning, which was lovely.
Oh, yes. In the morning when the sun comes up, it's... you can hear the first activity. And we thought, like, a lot of those little sounds were bubbles at first. But we've been told by plant experts that plants don't expire... bubbles of oxygen in the way that we expire sweat or something.
So what are they?
It comes out much more slowly. We're not quite sure.
Huh.
The experts, we have some people listening at the local agroforestry center that's about a quarter mile or so down the road to try to understand what sounds are what. And I think they're a little baffled.
Magical pond.
Well, have you walked down there? You see the turtles actually come up onto the... There's a little floating station on the water that is beaming the signal back here with a little transmitter on it. But the turtles like to sun themselves up on top. But if you come close, they scatter into the pond. You have to sneak up on them. Anyway, Amanda, we haven't gotten into... You're the current artist in resident here at Wave Farm, and... You're screening a... it's not finished yet. It's a work in progress, I guess.
That's correct. I'm going to show a work in progress.
And it's called... tell us what it's called and what it's all about.
Spectres of Shortwave is the English title, and the French title is Ombre des Ondes Courtes. And it's about a shortwave radio site that was recently dismantled in Canada. And the film... It's a feature-length experimental documentary, and it's about the Radio Canada International site. And that site was near where I grew up, so a lot of locals, and myself included, just saw it as this amazing, interesting part of the landscape. It was 13 radio towers, 400 feet tall, all connected with antennas, and it's situated in this marsh that's below sea level, so anytime you're driving home at night, what you see is all those red lights. And a lot of locals don't necessarily know what the site was for. And I started the project mostly documenting the images and the fact that people would hear the radio in their household appliances sometimes, sinks, fridges, toasters. And that fascinated me. And the more research I did, then I found out that was when I got interested in radio and shortwave radio. And as I started the film, our government made some pretty major budget cuts, and they decided to tear it down, so my project drew out for an extra few years to include the demolition of the site, which I think it was quite tragic.
They sell it for scrap metal, or?
Yeah, and I was told unofficially that, I mean, there was a station in Singapore that actually offered to buy it, and they basically said no. It was worth more to them as scrap metal. And when I was documenting the demolition, I wasn't allowed to post any photos on Facebook or Twitter because they were afraid people would come and steal metal. There was, I think they said, 60,000 pounds of copper from just the wires, let alone all the steel. So it wasn't...
And copper was going through a big price hike internationally at the time, I believe.
Yeah, that was 2014. They got quite a lot of money for that. And... So officially, like, even CBC and the Radio Canada, there wasn't a lot of documentation. I think one night they did a little thing on the evening news in English, and over the course of 4 months, twice on the French CBC, and no one else was documenting it. So I think it's still a work in progress phase, because editing the film right after it came down was a bit emotional for me. There was a lot of weight feeling like the only person who was there on site documenting as a kind of a witness to the loss of this very important piece of communication technology. It was the largest site of its kind in Canada, and it was built during World War II, and it was the first Allied site to break through the jamming signals of the Iron Curtain, and contracted by Radio China, Korea, Vietnam, quite a few other countries used this relay transmission site, and it was transmitting to the Arctic in the north of Canada, so... as a source of news for people in very remote communities up north, it was very important. And then there was this idea that, well, everyone's got the internet, so who needs shortwave, which I think is very short-sighted.
You said there's not much... you were the only documenter of the destruction. Is there a lot of documentation of the toasters receiving radio signals?
As far as I've come across, no one has done audio recordings of them, and I don't have audio recordings of them because that phenomenon apparently became less and less frequent after the 1970s. They put a lot of filters, they found
ways... And that's, of course, when the small cassette recorders became available in the 1970s.
Yeah, and so they did stuff with filters and helped people to prevent that from happening. There was an older woman in the community who apparently heard radio in her sink for 2 hours every Sunday evening, but she didn't want me coming into her house. She didn't. I didn't know. She was like the mother-in-law of a friend of a friend, and so I built my own radio sink. I took the schematic of a foxhole radio, or a crystal radio rather, and built it using copper plumbing. So I'd go to the plumbing store after every paycheck and buy another 12 feet of copper, and I would take it out on the marsh to try and hear the radio, trying to build a functioning radio without any electronics. In the end, it didn't work because I didn't have enough pipe. Like, I would have needed, I think, to catch the shortwave, I would have needed about 40 meters of pipe, and I had, you know, 24 feet because copper was expensive. So I'm still working on that project as well. So mostly what I've recorded is interviews with people who experienced hearing the radio from their fridge and their toaster and their sink, and most of it was in their childhood or teenage years. I didn't meet many people who still experienced that in 2010 to 2012.
And kind of your... It seems like what I'm hearing is your kind of theory of why that would happen is the same as why you would twist metal wires into to be able to receive signals in a foxhole radio is basically a term for during the war people made radios with whatever materials they had to receive signals, and so and this seems to go with along with the theremin too, is the twisting metal in certain ways, which is what the towers were doing on a large scale, a large, more organized scale, I guess, or maybe not, if it was causing sinks to become radius. But so is that what it's sort of a metaphor for the towers themselves, what you're doing?
With the theremin or the...
With the theremin, yeah.
Well, the theremin is kind of more of, because I'd been working on the project for about 5 years or more, and I became very emotionally attached to the towers. So the theremin became, that project's, it's a metaphor, but the project's called Requiem for Radio. And it's the idea is to play the ghosts of the radio towers with radio waves. So what I'll be doing with the theremins is there were 13 radio towers, and I want to build 13 theremins, one for each tower, to set up a scale model of the site. And the height of the theremin antennas will be relative to the height of the radio towers. And instead of hearing theremin sounds, it was interesting that you mentioned the contact mic recordings, because I had, when the towers were still standing, I put contact microphones on each of the radio towers to record their vibrations in the wind. At that point, they weren't transmitting anymore, but the marsh had very high winds. And so I've got these beautiful droning sounds that are almost like a voice for each tower. And so when I set up the scale model with the theremins, I'm writing a Maximus P patch so that the theremin becomes more of a trigger. So when you approach, say, theremin number 3, it'll trigger the sound of tower number 3. So it's this idea of conjuring the ghosts of the radio towers, even though it's all scientific and electromagnetic. It's this play of kind of requiem and remembering the past of that site.
And how did you first hear about this, or how did you first come into contact or discover that you wanted to go there and record and do all this?
It happened very gradually. I mean, growing up in the area, the towers were always just, they're on the side of the highway, and any time you came back from a long trip, you'd see those red lights, and you're like, oh, I'm almost home.
Do you know what the red lights are called?
The beacons.
Beacons.
Yeah, the beacons, the red beacons for so the airplanes don't hit them. And when the towers actually fell down, I collected a lot of the red glass from the beacons as well. I also got climbing certification and climbed two of them. But yeah, it all started like it was just a landmark. And then I took a radio building workshop with actually Peter Fleming, who was here earlier this summer as artist in residence. And we built radios out of toilet paper tubes and magnet wire. And mine picked up Italian radio. And at first I thought, oh, I did a great job. Then I found out, oh, no, I didn't do a great job. I'm just in an area with lots of international radio, and if people hear it on things even without trying. So I heard the story about people hearing it in their sink. That excited me. I built my radio sink, and I would take it out. And it's a small town of about 6,000 people. So I kind of became this quirky local character with a radio sink, and these old farmers, people I wouldn't otherwise meet, would see me downtown and be like, hey, did you hear the radio in your sink yet? And then they would start offering me stories from their childhood. And some of the stories these people had were incredible. And that's when I thought, oh, I should make a film. And so then I would visit the site to get a tour. And when I would go, if someone went with me, other people would get a headache or feel nauseous from the high voltage. I always felt a sense of elation, and I thought it was just because I was excited about my subject matter. Later on, I wonder if maybe that's the way my body reacts to high voltage.
You think that you're like one of these sinks, that you're slightly picking up radio waves?
Possibly. I'm one of these people, watches often stop working on me. I was electrocuted a lot as a kid. Apparently, my parents had trouble stopping me from sticking my fingers in the outlets. I apparently had a thing with electricity, and then I never thought about it until now, the last few years working with this. I look back over my life, and I'm like, oh yeah, I do have a problem with watches, and you know, maybe that was a biological response to high voltage, that every time I was on the site when it was operating, it was just a sense of like my heart would race, and I would just feel excited. And when the site stopped transmitting, that feeling wasn't there anymore. So it was kind of...
Wow, I've got like six topics I need to talk to you about, all different based on all that. Have you ever seen, do you know about the TV show Gilligan's Island?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the episode where Gilligan's teeth begin receiving radio signals?
I haven't seen that one, but I heard about someone near the radio towers whose filling disc didn't play it.
That happened in Canada, because the Gilligan's Island episode apparently is based on Lucille Ball, the comedian. Told this story for years in Hollywood, and it became famous, and so they made it into this script in Gilligan's Island. But about she drove by this part of town in Los Angeles and started hearing radio, started receiving radio in some sort of fake teeth or whatever she had in her mouth, some sort of metal in there. But it became this, like she told it on Johnny Carson show or something, and it became, or whatever the pre-Johnny Carson show was, and then it became this Gilligan's Island episode. And and then have you ever heard the Kristen Lucas, this more recent radio artist, she used to teach here nearby at Bard, had this piece where she pretended to be this person who received so many radio signals, was bombarded by so many radio signals, and it wrecked her life, and she had to be sent out into space in a satellite around the Earth because it was more free of radio signals, you know, like in a the way someone can't eat wheat or something. So she has to, so she has this piece about that. I can't remember the title, but you haven't heard that.
No,
either,
but that sounds incredible.
And then you said it was a part of the world where I guess things are more sensitive, and anything that's sort of like a radio receives radio signals.
Yeah. So
My question is there some sort of map somewhere where you can figure out if your part of the world is more sensitive to radio signals? Like, there's a place in West Virginia where the United States military has cordoned off radio signals. It's like you're not allowed to use cell phones, and so that's probably a place where your sync might not pick up the radio.
Yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't so much being part of the world, but being close to that shortwave site. So I was told that anything within 50 kilometers of that shortwave site.
Right, but I just wouldn't mean that part of the world because of that shortwave site.
Yeah.
So there's probably other
places.
Places like the Asheville Voice of America array that you were talking about.
Yeah.
It might be similar there.
Be similar there, yeah. Well, and it was interesting because I thought, well, this is hokey. These are just, you know, tall tales that people are telling. And so I got a book, the American Radio Relay League Handbook, had a chapter on external rectification or the rusty bolt effect. And it was all sorts of stuff on how to stop, how to prevent hearing stray frequencies. And syncs were one of them. Like, it actually listed how to stop hearing the radio in your sync. And I thought, oh, if they're telling you how to stop hearing it, I should be able to reverse engineer and make it happen. And the same thing with the fridges and the toasters. And
it was there, you spray it with WD-40, or what do you do when your sink is receiving radio signals?
I guess you have to find the rectifying joint, which is the, basically it's what it is if you have two different types of metal and a poorly soldered joint, that creates the diode that stands in for what would normally be the germanium diode. So you find that joint that has the two different pieces of metal and the poorly soldered joint, and either resolder it or ground it. Or so most of the solutions had to do with adding grounds.
And to reverse engineer it, to make your sync pick up more radio signals, you should do what?
I did a lot of practicing trying to find the right way to poorly solder two types of metal,
The correct way to incorrectly solder. What is the correct way to incorrectly solder?
I haven't quite succeeded yet. So.
You haven't perfected the incorrect way to solder yet.
No, and I thought that maybe it was a hopeless, I was like Don Quixote running at windmills and that this would never work. And I was thinking, well, okay, this is just a conceptual piece then, but I'd really hoped it would work. But I was about to give up when a guy from PEI he's retired.
He was a very bad solderer?
No, he was a radio technician professor at Holland College, and he heard about my project and wanted to see it. And he said, no, everything's correct. You just need a lot more copper pipe. So apparently my antenna wasn't long enough. But
right, because if you're trying to pick up a certain wave, you want to match your antenna to the size of the wave created by that frequency.
Exactly. It had to be the same wavelength or half a wavelength or quarter of a wavelength. And short wavelengths, even though it's called shortwave, they're extremely long. And copper was really expensive. And I didn't have any funding for this. I had a day job, and every paycheck I'd go and buy another 12 feet of pipe, which at the time was about $79.
And when you're explaining, we're not fully explaining, like you're trying to pick up waves that are giant, like AM radio, for instance. We have an AM radio transmitter on the property in the truck, and it has an antenna on the top that's about 12 feet tall or something, but it's like a quarter or something antenna. It's a version of it, and I think I was told that the wave is actually 384 feet high for this particular AM frequency, 1620 AM.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to make a very large sync.
Yeah, because I think I did the math with that guy. We did all the formulas, and it looked like I needed 40 meters of pipe, which for a quarter wavelength, which means 40 meters in feet, something like 4 times 3, it'd be about 120 feet, I think. Is that right? Yeah, it's 3 feet in a meter. So 3 feet in a meter, 40 meters, so 120 feet. for a quarter wavelength. So those, that means the full wavelength would have been 240, about 480 feet. So these were very, very long wavelengths.
I once, or when we were a micro radio station in Brooklyn, we moved from place to place and broadcast from different buildings all the time. But I found on several occasions in different buildings, we picked up, the building, it seemed like itself, was picking up 1620 or 1610? I can't remember. It was the station that, it was a New York Times classical station, then it got sold to Disney and became this horrible Radio Disney channel that played like bastardized, cleaned up versions of pop songs, you know, in kid form, instead of luscious classical music. So when the building was picking up the classical music, it was quite nice, and then it became quite horrible. But is that similar, or am
that's exactly similar. And so the other common issue that was still happening when I was there was that, but it wasn't as interesting to record, was that any sort of PA systems in town, like the churches or the bars, if there was a band playing, oftentimes the speakers would wind up playing international radio because it was an international radio station. So a common occurrence was there was one church in town, the pastor would be giving a sermon and there would be Chinese radio louder than him and they would be on the mixing board trying to fix it. There were two funeral parlors in the town, and one of them they would ask you, do you want to videotape the service? Because if you want to videotape it, you have to go to the other people. Because for some reason, this one funeral parlor, it didn't come out on the PA system, but only on the videotapes. So if you videotaped the funeral service, they would get international radio on the audio track of the video. And no one could figure out why, so they just would send their clients to the other parlor if they wanted it videotaped.
Well, you know, that reminds me, you know, when radio first came out, there was this whole theory that you could speak to the dead through radio waves. And like Houdini did. There was, you know, how Houdini was trying to suss out the fakes and the phonies, and I think Houdini did some work with radio about speaking to the dead through radio waves. So that funeral parlor is being somehow another piece for the conspiracy theorists that you can speak to the dead through radio waves.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny. My piece is called Spectres of Shortwave, and I talk about playing the ghosts of the radio towers with radio waves. But, you know, I wasn't thinking of going into the supernatural realm because that's kind of not really interested in going there. But I had a lot of friends later on start telling me all this stuff about how radio and television and stuff are the things that people use for their paranormal research. Well, that stuff kind of freaks me out. I was like, I don't want to go there. But it was interesting in that I watched this documentary on Bob Moog, the inventor of the synthesizer, and he sold a lot of theremin kits. And there's this beautiful scene where he just talks about how scientifically matter and energy is never created or destroyed. And he's like, you know, when we die, you know, we become, you know, our bodies become compost, and there's always the same amount of matter and energy, and there's electrons in our bodies. It's not necessarily an afterlife, but there's remaining energy. And I thought, okay, well, maybe that's a scientific explanation for these concepts of, I have no idea what I think about it, and I don't want, know if I want to go down that road, but I do find it interesting that this idea of the energy, electrons from our bodies, especially when things like theremins and radio that deal with capacitance. So in capacitance, you're able to play a theremin because electrons are jumping from your hand through the air to the antenna, and the air is the semiconductor, and so if I play that theremin, that means actual electrons or energy from my body is passing into that circuit. And then later on, it'll pass out of that circuit into something else. Now, there's no personality or emotion or anything connected to that, but it's still kind of interesting, this transferal of these invisible energies. And that's why I think it's interesting about radio, too. Like the radio waves, we don't see them, but they're part of the landscape. They're like these invisible landscapes or architectures because we are building and planning them, and so it's something that I find really interesting, but definitely haven't totally wrapped my head around, but there's a lot of interesting avenues.
So we're speaking with Amanda Dawn Christie about her film in progress, Spectres of Shortwave, which will be shown 4 p.m. Saturday, October 17th at TSL in Hudson. So my question is, to, I guess, to before if we got too metaphysical or whatever, to get it statistically, when people were receiving radio in their sinks and in appliances and their toasters and hearing it, were they hearing current live radio broadcasts or were they hearing historic radio broadcasts?
Current live radio broadcast, but it was international radio, so it was often in foreign language.
Which was confusing, but it was actually tied to those towers.
Right. Yeah.
The tower was, it's been proven, had something to do with, they weren't foreign broadcasts that had nothing to do with the local tower.
No, they were, so that site was an international relay station, so they had their own programming broadcasting in multiple languages. It was situated to broadcast to Europe, Africa, South America, and the Arctic. And then also, because the shortwave could hit half the globe, they were subcontracted by countries on the other half of the globe. So they would download files from China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam and broadcast for those countries. So they were live broadcasts, and that site was just the transmission site. And anyone who lived within 50 kilometers, if their household appliances were set up in such a way to catch the radio, they would. And there was, so sometimes they would hear clear voices, and sometimes it was more like, especially in the sink stories that I heard, it was more muffled. Like you could hear, it was almost like static, or there was some sort of sound coming from the sink that was unidentifiable. Other times I was told it sounded like someone in a distance. There was a family that had a dairy farm nearby, and the two men that live there now, they were children at the time, now they're retired, but they said when they were kids, they'd come home from school, and they knew it was the radio. It would come off the radiators, but he said it would sound like if a man was hiding in your basement and trying to talk in a low voice, that's what it sounded like. And so they knew what it was, but it was still scary, and they would still have to go around the house and check and make sure there was no one hiding in the house. Another couple, they when they opened the fridge, they heard radio, and they could get like the weather in Pakistan. And it would be, like, really clear. And ironically, the local radio...
It would never be raining.
Yeah. Well, and he said they didn't get the local radio because it's below sea level. So he's like, if you want to know the weather, look out the window.
What was my question going to be? I had a different question, but I'll go back to another question I remember I had from earlier was, you said you climbed towers, you got certified to climb towers.
Yeah.
And was that also kind of thrilling? Because I mean, you're actually like touching the the transmission, and you're also up above everything. I don't know. So just, can you give us a sort of explanation of what that experience was like?
Yeah. So the towers themselves were support for the antennas. In that site, the antennas were actually the wires that ran horizontally between them. And I climbed after it was no longer operational, just before they were demolished. I wasn't sure I would be allowed, and I got my permission very last minute. They're like, okay, do your climbing course now. And it was an online climbing course. So that I passed at, I think, like at 2 in the morning, and I went and I climbed. The first one I climbed at 7:30 in the morning on February 4th of 2014, and it was minus 11 degrees without the wind chill. So it was very, very cold. And I hadn't had breakfast or much sleep. And I picked the tallest tower there, the 433-foot tower. I was like, I want to climb to the top of that. And it was very difficult. My harness, the safety thing was sticking, so it was extra work to force that up. And I only made it 120 feet up, and I felt like such a failure. But it's quite physically exhausting climbing straight up. And especially in the winter where everything was cold and icy, like my gloves were sticking to the rungs, peeling my gloves off. The experience, the most intense part of the experience was the silence. Because they were starting demolition and you get up a certain height and you don't hear any of the heavy machinery around. You don't hear the highway. It was just wind and silence. And then the second tower was in April after all the other towers were down. I decided to try again because I felt so bad for not having made it 120 feet. Now, the demolition crew, they told me that 120 feet is pretty good. A lot of times when people start climbing, they don't make it past 60. Still, it wasn't even halfway. So the last tower standing was 250 feet. And that one, I made it up to the top. And I got up again, it was very weird and sad because at that point everything else is gone, and this is the last tower on this flat marshland. It's no longer functional, and I got up to the top, and well, what I thought was the top, and there was an eagle's nest, and there was a retired rigger climbing with me for safety. And he said, okay, we'll get you out of the tower outside and up onto the beacon now. I was like, oh, no, that's okay. I've made it to the top. I'm good, 250 feet. He just said, well, you're not at the top. You're 20 feet from the top. But if you want to quit now, that's okay. I won't force you. And then, of course, I was like, well, I'm not going to quit. We'll get outside and up onto the beacon. And it was incredible. Again, silent, perfectly. There's so much traffic on the highway below, and you hear nothing but the wind.
You weren't picking up radio signals.
There's no radio at that point. The site had already stopped transmitting 2 years prior. And it was very sad, but beautiful. It was incredible. And then also knowing that I was the last person at the top of the last tower was kind of interesting. But again, it was a sad experience.
So I know the question I had before was, were there any accounts of animals reacting to radio waves that they were hearing through their milker or whatever, in the morning? Or did they always congregate around one thing because they were hearing sounds? Or,
well, apparently, so there was originally a very large dairy farm nearby, and CBC actually wound up buying the farm so that the family would move because cows were dying. It was such a high voltage, high power site that sometimes if a gate wasn't closed enough, electricity would arc enough to kill a cow. And on that site, the woman would get the mother got shocks when she put her clothes out on the laundry line, but it was a metal line, and when she sent the line out rolling, spinning, when the wire was moving on the rollers, you could hear radio, and when it stopped, you didn't. Those were the boys who I interviewed, or they're grown men now, but who, when they were kids, heard the voices in the house. So, and they also said that at times lights in the house would just light up. You wouldn't turn them on; they wouldn't come all the way. But when they started transmitting to Africa or the Caribbean, all of a sudden the lights in the house would just come up halfway as if they were on a dimmer switch. So there were interesting stories like that. And then in terms of animals, for a while the Canadian Bird Studies. There was a bird studies program collecting birds from the feet of the tower to see if it was causing a problem. And I don't think it was causing any more of a problem than any other power lines. And there were foxes nearby. After the site was shut down but still standing, I did a lot of camping nearby to film and do sound recording. And there were definitely foxes and owls and deer and pheasants. So a lot of wildlife. And the foxes seemed to live right on the site. But again, there used to be security guards that would feed the foxes hot dogs. And by the time I showed up, there were no more security guards. But the foxes... But
the foxes still looking for security guards.
Yeah, yeah. And they were very friendly. I remember one time I was there and this fox came up. There was me and someone else. And he was maybe about 10 feet from us, looked at us, and did that thing where they jump up and down on the ground. And then he would run away about 6 feet and turn around to look and see if we were following. And then he would jump a couple times. You know, it was almost like he wanted us to follow him. But,
So any of the health-related issues that were reported sound like they were due to electricity more than radio wave transmission.
Yeah, now, I did interview the widow of a man who had worked there. She started working there in 1944, I believe, and met her husband there. And so he was one of the first engineers there and had died of cancer from a radiation burn. And she said that there's a lot of the men who had been working there in the early period, the 40s, the 50s, and 60s, had all died of a certain type of cancer. And then there's some locals who say that there's a higher rate of MS, multiple sclerosis, in the region. So there's questions about whether or not that high-power radio transmission site next to an active community caused health problems. I don't think there's any statistical documentation. It's all word of mouth. And then there's also...
So it could have been like the marsh itself had high iron components or something, you know.
Exactly.
Knows?
Yeah, it could have been anything.
But it could have been the radio waves.
It could have been. And then there's other more extreme stories. One guy from the region swore that he believed the radio towers could make him dream in other languages and that they were going to cause people to evolve to have telepathy. And I enjoyed hearing everyone's
theories. It sounds like
theories.
The Gilligan's Island thing again. He's like in his sleep picking up radio signals in his teeth and then turning them into dreams.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And so, and he was a musician, so he had a lot of guitar amps around. So he actually phoned, and this story is in my film, it's one of my favorite stories. He phoned the radio station when he realized he was dreaming in other languages to see if the towers had anything to do with it. And he got a technician on the line, and the technician asked where he lived and what time he was sleeping, and said probably it was happening in his hypnagogic state, because that state between waking and sleeping as he's drifting off to sleep is when they started broadcasting to another country in a foreign language. And so as he's drifting off to sleep in his hypnagogic state, he's hearing Chinese radio coming off his guitar amps. I later on met the technician who I had talked to. So neither of these two guys knew each other's name, but I'd kind of heard the same story from two different sources, and they both tell the story very differently. And it's like the guy who felt it made him dream was going to be, he's like, oh yeah, the guy at the radio station confirmed that these towers do affect the way people dream. Whereas the guy from the station was like, no, it was his guitar amplifiers when he's falling asleep.
Was there any local radio stations in this array, or mm-hmm. And could they beam thoughts into people's heads?
I don't think so. That site primarily broadcasts very long distances, and then there's a local community station nearby, but they definitely weren't able to broadcast into people's heads.
No one did a radio play from the community station based on the fact that you could hear the show through the sink?
I don't know. I mean, I would think possibly. Over the, like, in the 70 years that site was there and operational, there's a lot of people in that. It's a very vibrant arts community, especially for a town of 6,000 people. There's a ton of artwork made about them, paintings, photography, etc., plays, poetry, music. So those towers and that site manifested in probably every art form imaginable over the past 70 years, because it was such an impressive site, and it's in the midst of this very active arts community. So I'm sure I'm not the only one to do something about the sinks, but I haven't heard of anyone else doing it.
There's not an album music for sinks out or something?
Not yet.
What was the most surprising thing you learned in this whole process?
The most surprising? There were so many surprises.
While you're thinking, we're way in the background. There's a brand new record from Scanner. It's called Narnia, original score for ballet, and it's just out. And we're also hearing the sounds of the pond, too, here at Wave Farm in the background. Did I give you enough time to think about it?
Yeah. Well, I think the most surprising thing is probably the most obvious. It was just that what the site was used for broadcasting around the world, and the fact that here's this site that I saw almost every day my whole life and just had never really questioned too much about what it did. And I was shocked that I had, you know, I was like, oh yeah, it's some radio thing. And then realizing the immense importance that it played for people, and also realizing that I wasn't the only one, that a lot of people in the area never thought about it either. To everyone, it's just like, oh yeah, those are the radio towers. But if you said, what do they do? That surprised me how much people didn't think about what do they do. And it surprised me, and I was also disappointed in myself that I had, until that point, never really asked, well, where do they broadcast? Like, what do they do? And when I realized that, you know, that site was quite important for broadcast to South America, Africa, Europe, and the Arctic, and now with the transition to digital radio and the internet, that it's a real loss for various people around the world, because radio is affordable. You can build radios out of easy-to-access materials, but you can't build a digital receiver computer as easily.
The router is not as easy. There's not a foxhole router.
No, exactly. So I think that surprised me how important that site really was.
I don't know. Maybe we should talk to some troops in Afghanistan. Is there a foxhole router in Afghanistan?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, It would probably be a lot more complicated,
you'd
but
think.
Maybe it's...
you'd think. I don't know. We'll have to ask that question at some time. Do you think people that lived in that area had a more higher sense of the physicality of the airwaves that surround everybody all the time? They kind of thought about that a little bit more because the airwaves were seeming like a lot more physical than they are, say, here, where... we're bombarded with all kinds of signals right now here, but we don't have as much of a sense of the spaghetti of waves hitting us.
Mm-hmm. I think for sure, yeah. So even though people might not be asking what did that site actually do or where did it broadcast, there was a real awareness that it was broadcasting something and those waves were everywhere because even if everyone didn't hear the radio in their sink, they definitely picked it up on any sort of PA system. There was a lot big music scene there, so... A lot of rock, indie rock shows and concerts. And
you ended up improvising with the local radio then.
Yeah, or international radio.
Whether you wanted
to or not, you would wind up having Chinese or Japanese radio coming through along with your band, and you'd have to find a way to work around that and how to work with it or around it, yeah. So people became very aware of like speaker placement and cabling and I think also
the local Radio Shack did very well. You're saying like people went and buy things to like fix the.
Well, it was actually because it's such a small
grounding.
Community. They would often just call the folks at Radio Canada International and be like, "Hey, we've got a problem here," and they would do their best to come and help with shielding and stuff. So actually, it was the site itself would help because it was a small community. And so, like I said, that there was one church where it was really bad, and so the folks from the radio station went and helped them figure out a solution.
So the community had the highest aptitude for electrical loss and grounding and those kind of concepts.
Probably, yeah.
Higher than like any other place in the world, or
quite possibly. I wonder what in North Carolina, where the Voice of America site is. I'd be curious to know if they have similar issues around that site.
Higher percentage of Radio Shacks and things like that. And now there's just a little stick with a router on it in the field.
Now there's nothing, and I do want to call and follow up. They were selling the towers were all torn down and sold for scrap metal. And then the building was auctioned, and I believe a demolition company got it. The land, there's some pollution in the land, so it can't be farmed. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to the land. But right now the land, it's just totally flat. And at the same time as the radio towers were coming down, a wind farm was put up nearby. So now there's windmills. So it's almost like
they
that.
Pick up radio signals.
I don't know if they pick up... But it's almost like that marsh is like destined to have vertical things there because it used to be shipbuilding, and then there was no more shipbuilding, and then it was radio towers, and now it's windmills. It's almost like that piece of land.
Is it because it's so low? You said it was below sea level,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's flat marsh. It's a saltwater marsh below sea level.
So it has a less of a visual impact because it falls below the horizon quicker or something?
Or more of a visual impact. Like it's just destined to have these like vertical intrusions in the landscape or something. But and that was the other thing that was crazy, because it's such a high power site, like their power bill was in the millions of dollars. Like their each transmitter was running on it was 13,000 volts was the.
So they should have had those windmills out there a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, to power this site. But this site was also between like it's if you don't know the geography of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, it's on the border of the two, and those two provinces are connected by a tiny little bridge of land. And there's ocean on both sides. Nova Scotia's almost an island, but not quite. It's connected with this little piece of land, and the Atlantic Ocean wraps around one side as the Bay of Fundy, and the other side is the Northumberland Strait. And these towers are on that tiny little bridge of land between two bits of ocean, and the ocean is held back by dikes, and it's on a marsh. Like, that seems like a sketchy place to put a high-power facility, but apparently it was the perfect place during the Second World War because... it's a saltwater marsh, which conducts electricity better, so the ground waves kicking off went further, and it was right on the edge of the ocean, and shortwave travels better
over
the water, so for getting to South America, Africa, and Europe, it was the perfect geographic location. But in terms of power and electricity, and, you know, if water levels rise with global warming, that's...
When they do, yeah.
Yeah.
And the area has a history of broadcasting before this because of that location. It was there were some early experiments, like, to England, I believe, from there, right? Weren't there?
Not that spot. Marconi nearby. Yeah, so still on the Atlantic coast of Canada. So that would be a bit of a ways, but, yeah, still the east coast of Canada, Marconi in Newfoundland. And then also Alexander Graham Bell did a lot of experiments in Cape Breton in Nova Scotia. So, yeah, that area, because of its location with the ocean, was pretty good. So, yeah.
All right, we're speaking with Amanda Dawn Christie about Spectres of Shortwave, which an early unfinished version will be shown Saturday, October 17th at 4 p.m. at Time Space Limited in Hudson. Do you want to tell people anything about the film if they're thinking about coming?
Sure. At this point, it's a 60-minute cut. Eventually, well, it might be a little longer depending on how much extra work I do while I'm here this week. and it started off as a landscape film, so it's not your traditional documentary. There's no talking heads. You're not going to see any people, but you'll hear people, like listening to the radio. And the imagery is, I filmed the site over four seasons, so spring, summer, fall, winter. And so it's various shots of the site, long, slow, meditative, a lot of driving shots. I filmed on 35mm film and scanned to digital. And then in the winter is the demolition. So the last 20 or 30 minutes of the film is just watching the site being dismantled. And the soundtrack, you'll hear stories from local residents in English and French, and because there's two languages in the region. And the film is, I chose not to subtitle it because radio is not subtitled. And one of the things I found interesting about international radio is that there are so many languages and you don't always understand them. So to me, if you don't understand one of the languages, I'm treating it like it's music. And it's just, imagine you're tuning into international radio. And the background sounds, there's these drones. And those drones in the background were all recorded when I placed contact microphones on the radio towers. And then the very final 20, 30 minutes. So you'll hear people talking in the first two-thirds of the film. Locals talking about the significance of the landscape. There's a section of people talking about hearing the radio in their household appliances. And there's sections of the technicians explaining how the site worked and what it did. And then as we watch the demolition, there's no voices. At that point, we're just watching. And my approach to making a documentary is I want the viewer to be more in the seat of a witness than a student. I didn't want to be an authority telling you how it is and what it is. I wanted it to be as if you stumbled across it the way I did. And that's why I've intercut stories by locals. So you're going to overhear the same stories that I heard when I was living there. And when the camera is going through the facility, because I also went inside the facility, going through the hallways and the transmitters and everything, I'm not necessarily going to explain what they are. It's going to be as if you've arrived there and you're exploring it on your own and overhearing local stories. And when the demolition happens, I want you to feel like you're there too, watching it like I did. So
I've never seen a demolition of an antenna array. Is it like one of these spectacular shots where they go to Las Vegas where they're blowing up the old casino to put in the even bigger new casino, and they show the building like all come down at once? Does it like fall like a giant redwood tree and all at once, and or is it a crane that just takes it apart piece by piece?
It's pretty dramatic. They had two options for demolition. They could have either blown them up with explosives or dropped them, like have it just topple over.
Timber. And do they yell timber?
They don't quite yell timber, but they could. It's exactly like that. And they basically, they slack off all the wires until there's just three wires holding it up. And they had to wait till the wind was the right direction. And they had to do it in the winter because of the marsh and how, you know, being a soft, mushy ground. So it was done in the dead of winter, incredibly cold and icy. Wait till the wind is in the right direction, and then they just take a blowtorch and they cut one wire. And then the tension of the other two wires pull the tower over with such force that it rips it out of the ground, so it actually jumps up a bit.
The three guy wires or whatever
they
call it?
Yeah, just the guy wires holding it. And they cut one of them, and the other two pull it over, and it jumps out of the ground. And it, on its way down, it kind of twists and creaks, and it hits. And because of the snow, it's not as loud of a crash as you would think.
It's more the winter, yeah.
It's like a poof. You hear this in the snow, and they're so tall that I think I remember one of them I timed. It was like took 12 seconds to fall. Like it's, they just kind of start slowly, and you hear the metal creaking, and then it hits. What took the longest time was bringing the wires down, and that's slow, very beautiful, but that could take 20 minutes. So it was hard to capture that in film because it was, you know, I couldn't spend 20 minutes just watching one of them. So trying to get excerpts, but that one, there were all these webs of what they call curtains, these horizontal wires running between the towers and different layers, and they would use a winch and slowly lower them. So you had all these wires that were super tight, and they just gradually droop and sag and lower. So they spent about a month or two doing that. I filmed the demolition for about 4 months. Let's see, February, March, I guess maybe 3 months. So January, February, March, April. And the bulk of the demolition was spent getting the wires down. And then once the wires were down, the towers dropped pretty fast. Sometimes they would drop 3 towers in a day. Other times, nothing would happen for 3 days because the wind was too high. So it was a lot of waiting. And then once it went, it was like, okay, here it goes.
Did they sound a warning to clear people away or when they were about to do it or something?
Well, there was almost no one around because, like I said, when I was there, I wasn't allowed to tell anyone about it. Like, local people in Sackville knew because it's a small community. And, like, people who knew me knew I was there filming. Driving on the highway, people were like, oh, there's one less tower. Some people talked about how they didn't even notice it happening. It wasn't publicized at all. There were probably a few people. I said I was the only one documenting, but I'm sure a few people went out in the afternoons or to take some photos from a distance. I was the only one on site. The demolition crew was 12 men from Newfoundland. They weren't even from around there. They hired a company from Newfoundland. And I would show up at 5 a.m. to set up my gear. The crew arrived at 7. I'd get a radio, like a walkie-talkie, because that was when they started. And they would go do their thing, and I would set up for whatever angle I wanted. And on the walkie-talkie, at a certain point, they would yell, okay, Amanda, we're cutting. And so I was allowed to be there, sort of, as long as I wasn't in their way. And so I couldn't slow them down. It had to be like, when they were ready to go, they're ready to go, and I better be ready and waiting. So some days I waited for 10 hours and nothing happened. And other days, I would just barely be set up when the first tower was falling for the day. So it was pretty intense.
And again, we're speaking with Amanda Dawn Christie, whose work in progress, Specters of Shortwave, will screen at 4 p.m. Saturday, October 17th at Time and Space Limited in Hudson. And is a Wavefarm artist in resident for the next week, and we're going to cut away in just a minute to Radio Wonderland, Joshua Fried remixing New York City Radio live from Brooklyn on Hudson Valley Frequencies. Amanda, it's been great to speak with you this morning, and I guess we'll be hearing the film on the air, too, at Time and Space Limited, and then we're going to be playing it on the air at 4 p.m. next Saturday, October 17th.
Sounds great. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you for coming up and talking to us.